Get a deeper connection with the Cougars of BYU Sports.
God gives us a gift, and we use that gift until he takes it away.
Deep Blue.
Just sitting down afterward and being really tired and thinking like, wow, I just won the U.S. championship.
This is Deep Blue. Here's your host, Jason Shepherd.
Thanks for tuning in for a new episode of Deep Blue. This is the show where we get to know the person behind the number that you see on the field or the court. These are the true stories of BYU athletes from their own mouths. Today, it's part two of our conversation with former BYU defensive lineman and current Cougar football radio color analyst, Hans Olsen. Now, if you haven't listened to part one yet, make sure to check it out before diving into this episode. In the first part, we covered a lot about football. Now, we'll explore how football has shaped Hans as a person. When football really entered your life, and you mentioned obviously your uncle being Merlin Olsen, and we know all of his accolades, not just certainly at Utah State, but in the NFL with the Rams. And I mean, everybody knows who Merlin Olsen is if you follow the NFL at any time. Was it always a foregone conclusion you were going to be a football player because of the history and the family? You also mentioned you were a bigger kid. Was it just this was inevitable for you?
No, it wasn't. I was a very chubby, unathletic kid, very chubby and very unathletic, to the point where everybody thought I'd end up being Tommy Boy. I'm not kidding you. My mom had delivered a classic line. She was like, we either knew he was going to be something successful or be Tommy Boy. That was the two options for him. My mom is an entertainer. She's incredible. But a lot of people thought, like all my teachers and everybody, they thought this kid's going to be a bum. You know, I had a severe learning disorder and severe attention deficit my entire life. And I had to redo grades. I was held back multiple times and struggled. I remember being able to learn how to write my name. I remember being able to how to decipher colors. Like, I don't know how many people out there remember seeing green and thinking that's green, but I remember when I could finally look at it, be like, oh, okay, so that's green, that's orange, that's red. So I had to deal with a lot of different learning disabilities as I came along, always in resource class and always behind in class, always. And when I got into high school, there were three new coaches that were brought into Weezer, Idaho, my freshman year. In high school, a guy named Jeff Murphy, a wrestling coach named Kevin Knight, and then a assistant coach for both named John Lumberg. They were all out of their college sports. They were all fresh, green-nosed, ready to take on the world and ready to take on the hardest-headed projects. And you know, I talk about these amazing blessings in life. As much as I want to beat those guys, they were the greatest blessing in my life because they took a kid that was afraid, that was beat down by teachers, that was doubted by other coaches, that had a mom that believed in him. My mom always believed me, and she would always say, Hans, you're going to be a great man. Even though she might not have believed it, she'd tell me you're going to be a great man. And God put these coaches in line, and they beat me to death. And when I tell you, Shep, it was to death. Those guys they harmed me in ways I don't even want to talk about. They just were mean. But they knew we're either going to break him and get him going in another area in life, or we're going to make him an athlete. And that's when it started to come together.
Okay, so why do you think, though, because you're right, it can go one of two ways. Why do you think it went the way it did for you? Was it a conscious decision on your part to not let it break you? Like, why did it work out as opposed to being something that destroyed you?
Well, you know, I don't know if I've ever put myself in thought of that, but as you ask it, and I put myself into those seventh and eighth grade shoes, you know, those times were difficult. I had what I think was a setup arrest. I was brought into the sheriff's office and read my rights when I was 12. And I had these really tough moments that it was like, where are you going? And I think in those moments, when I had the coaches bearing down on me and the pressures of sport, I started to say, you know, I'll show them. I'll show you. I'll show everybody. Like, I'll do this. And it was more of a stubborn where I felt like this was my area that I could show people. This was my area where I could get out of Weezer. This was my area where I could possibly pay for college or I could possibly make some money because I couldn't do it anywhere else, Shep. My brother's a professional opera singer. I don't know if you know that.
I do know that.
He is a renowned opera singer, and every teacher loved him, and he was on a roll, straight A, 4.0. He was taught by Michael Ballum at Utah State and went on and got his master's at the Cincinnati Conservatory, and he was the angel in the family, and he would beat me to a pulp. He would just hammer me. And I remember thinking, I got to find a way to be successful somehow. And it's not through music. I can't play an instrument. I can't hit a note. It wasn't through academics. I knew that. I could hardly pull a D plus C minus in classes. If it wasn't for teachers looking at me like, we just got to move him on. The other teachers had me for another year. And they're like, just give him an advancing grade. And then my sophomore year where it was like, oh, this kid, he might be. Then it was like, okay, give him enough of a grade that the clearinghouse will let him be eligible and we'll get him out of Weezer.
Right.
But it was an area where I started to realize, I'll show you. And then between my freshman and sophomore year, my body started to change. Between my sophomore and junior year, my mind and body changed. And then it was off to the running. It was between my sophomore and junior year that a teammate on my team in high school said, you know, you could be really good at this. And his name was Jason Bruce. And I remember the conversation because it was a real spark of realization. He said, you could be really good at this. And I was like, you think? And he's like, your uncle's a Hall of Famer. Like, you're the best on the team. At the time, I didn't realize it because my coaches kept my ego down.
Right.
And it was the first time I was like, you think? And he's like, dude. And then it was that year that, you know, the colleges really started to reach out. And then by the end of my junior year, I was flooded with every university and every offer and every opportunity. And it was pretty cool because it was that moment where it was like, yeah, I could hit people with I told you so's. And this is my shot. And this is what I can do with my life.
The original plan, even though we know how it turned out, was not to come to BYU. You were not coming to BYU. You were actually going to be wearing red. And it's not the red that people may think. We're talking about Nebraska.
Yeah.
Then something changed. What changed?
This is crazy. So I took my official trips, took five official trips, none of them to BYU. I took one out to Nebraska, and I had committed to a coach named Tom Osborne out there.
Legend.
Tom flew out to Weezer, Idaho. Private jet, landed on a Weezer airstrip, and was at my house at 7:30 in the morning before a wrestling practice. Tom Osborne in Weezer, Idaho. He told me it's the first and only time he'd ever recruited in Idaho. And he's at my front door, and I committed to him. And I said, yes, sir, Mr. Osborne, we're going to do this. And Lavelle came in real late, like real late. And I'll never forget the first piece of BYU that I saw was Tom Ramage, defensive line coach, showed up at Weezer High School in his BYU gear, pulled me out of class with his gigantic size fingers, poked me in the chest and said, you're coming to BYU. And I was like, you're out of your mind. All of these universities wined and dined and they've been on my butt for a couple years and you're out of your mind, old man. Like, what are you even talking about? And he looked at me and said, you're going to be coming to BYU. And so he left. And not too long after that, Lavelle showed up at my door. Lavelle sat down with my parents and he said, Hans is what we need. And I want to start by offering a sincere apology that we're in late on this. This is our loss and this was our mistake. And, you know, my uncle Orrin Olson played here and he was on Lavelle's first team as a head coach. So he was – Orrin was Lavelle's first year as a head coach. I was Lavelle's last year as a head coach. So me and my uncle kind of bookended. And he said, you're going to be coming to BYU, and this is why. And he laid out the plan. And, Shep, when it comes down to it, at the end of that meeting, you know, it was very cool. It's a very cool meeting. You know, I won't go into all the details, but it was a very cool meeting where he shared a lot of parts of the gospel and a lot of things that were possible. And it was things I needed to hear because, as I've mentioned, I was way off the path. And people ask me, well, why didn't you serve a mission? Well, my mission was trying to convert me first before I could convert anybody else. And I was very real with myself. I wasn't going to be a fake missionary. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to do that. Had too many friends that were doing it. I had friends that were leaving for missions that I knew were worse than I was. And I was like, I'm not going to be that guy. But I wanted to find that. I wanted to find whatever it was that made my parents happy. And I felt like Lavelle was offering that. And as Lavelle was walking out the door, I had a thought. And I thought, ask him. And I said, Lavelle. He turned around. I said, will you be there for my 5 years of eligibility? Because he was old.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, he was 65. And I said, will you be there for my years of my five? And he turned and looked me in the eye and goes, I will be there for all 5 years of your eligibility. And he was the only coach that was able to answer that question. I'd asked Oregon. I'd asked Tom Osborne. He couldn't commit to it. All the universities that I was considering, I'd asked, and Lavelle was the only one that could answer it. And he said, I'll be there. And by darned,
he was.
He was until the final day. And we both left in 2000 together. And it was a pretty incredible thing. But 2 weeks before signing date is when I made the decision. And I didn't call Nebraska.
Ever?
Nope. Never called him.
Do you regret that?
No. Nope. No, because what people need to understand is, as a player, you're a pawn just as much as they're a pawn.
So you didn't feel there was any obligation to have to call Nebraska?
No. Nope. You're being used more than they're being used. And this is a business. And if I could go back and I felt like I wasn't a pawn to them, then maybe I'd call and be like, hey, I know I meant something more than just a football player to you. But in the long run, Shep, the coach / recruiting process and recruit process, until it's real, it's all surface level.
Well, and you're going through this. You have other children who play different sports, but your son just has committed to Utah State.
Oh, yeah.
So
yes.
You've gone – how is it different now as the parent watching your son, knowing what you went through? It's obviously different now than it was then.
Yeah.
But how is it watching the recruiting process now, watching it through the lens of your son versus when it was you yourself?
It's way different. It's so incredibly different because I just look at him and I just know all he is a piece of meat to anybody. That's all he is. Until they get to know how beautiful a heart this kid is and how amazing, how bright of a shining star he is and how he makes me laugh every day and how he hugs his mom because he's a mama's boy and how beautiful he is when he laughs and how he attempts to make everybody laugh that he comes across. Until they know, all he is a piece of meat. And how I look at people that look at my son as a piece of meat, I'm like, I have no use for you.
Right.
All you think of my son is, how can he help you win football games? Okay, well, I'll get my son ready to help you win football games because he needs an education and he needs money. But until you know why Rock Olsen is Rock Olsen, until you understand that he is the greatest thing in my life, then I have no use for you. But when you realize it, he's going to be something way more than a football player to you because he's one of the most beautiful things that this earth has ever known. He's such an incredible human being. And So as a parent, you look at it like, until you know my kid, you just look at him in a way to win the game that you're responsible for coaching. I'll get him ready and he'll win for you because I'm going to teach my kid his responsibilities and his work ethic, but don't expect to have a relationship with him. Just know he'll show up for meetings and he will win for you, but don't sit there and try to appease me with, oh, I love your son. He's the greatest thing ever when you're recruiting him. And it's like, you don't know him. You just want him for
yeah.
his 6'7", 320-pound frame. You want him because his last name is Olsen, and Olsens play football. That's what we do. But understand, he is more beautiful than Merlin. He is way more beautiful than me. He is one of the most beautiful things this earth has ever known. And it goes way beyond football. And so you can see, Shep, it's kind of a unique thing.
Yeah.
And it's like I look at coaches like, yeah, just try. Now, there are coaches that have known him since he's a young boy. And, you know, they know that he's a special kid. And those coaches I'll listen to. But for the most part, the recruiting process is very superficial. And I know that.
What a great tribute to your son, from a father to a son. What that was fantastic.
Well, I hope he doesn't hear this. Because I don't know if you've ever seen him on Twitter or
something. I have.
He's harsh. But it's a joke.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's just having some fun.
We see each other at the end of the day after he'll fire a tweet off and I'm like, dude, really? You got to call out my weight, or you got to call out my age, you know, and we laugh and he's like, oh, I told you. I can't do anything about it now because the kid is, he repped out 315, I think 8 times, and he's just finishing up his high school.
Wow.
315, 8 times. I think he's maxing out at 365 or 385. I didn't hit that until like my sophomore year in college. And so I don't mess with him. He'll scoop me up off the ground.
You gotta tread lightly.
Oh, he'll tell me, Dad, I need some eggs. Oh, well, could you just make me some eggs? I'll get that done. I'll get your eggs.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. would you like some bacon too? Can I get you some bacon, son?
Can I refill that plate? Is everything okay?
Eggs are $7 a dozen, son.
Yeah.
You just ate $24 in eggs.
Oh boy, yeah. We can spend an entire podcast talking about the price of eggs these days.
Oh yeah, but I do love him, and you know you feel that way about all your kids, and you know that, Shep. But he's an incredible kid. But it does put a different spin on how you feel about coaches. And there's no question.
Yeah.
And I've lost some friends through the process. I've got people that I thought were good friends. I've lost friends because it's like, nah, you don't care about my kid. And that's okay. We'll just move on. We'll be business relations. That's fine.
Yeah.
But he's a beautiful kid. I'm excited to see him grow in the game.
Let's take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Hans Olsen and discuss the impact the 1996 BYU football team had on him. This is the Deep Blue Podcast on BYU Radio. Hey, Cougar fans, Jason Shepherd here to talk about one of our other great BYU Radio podcasts, Big Stories. It's a show about amazing stories from Big 12 schools and beyond. Host Cleon Wall traveled to places like Tempe, Lawrence, Orlando, and other cities to find real-life tales from BYU's opponents, like Baylor grad Jimmy Durrell, who moved back to an impoverished Waco neighborhood to help those who couldn't help themselves. Cleon has plenty of stories just like that through the football and basketball seasons. Don't miss out. Find Big Stories on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Welcome back to Deep Blue. Let's get back to our conversation with former BYU football player and current radio analyst Hans Olsen. You were on the roster in 96 when the team won the Cotton Bowl. Now you were a redshirt freshman that season.
That's right.
But you were around some of the greats on that roster. What type of standard do you think that helped set, that season set for you moving forward?
It was a high standard. Really high standard, and the leaders on that team were really pure leaders and high integrity, high motor, and I sure loved them, but it did set the standard. And we just had that 96 reunion.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, we were doing the pre—
I remember. So, okay, I got to tell the story. I We do the pregame out at Cougar Canyon outside, and they were going to have all of the players from that 96 team walk down like where the team does for like the Cougar walk before the games. And everybody that was associated with the 96 team got a special like pullover sweater.
Yeah.
And I remember how touched you were when you put that on. Because didn't have yours before when we started pregame, but they came over and they gave you one, if I remember correctly. And you quickly put that on and you were glowing.
Yeah.
Looking at that logo and knowing what that season meant and that that was the beginning of your career. I'm glad you brought that up because I remembered that moment and how much I know it meant to you.
Oh, it was incredible. Again, I cried. And that's fine. Like I'm a big ball baby, and that's fine. But Ben Cahoon came by the booth, and Ben said, "Hey, everybody's down there. They want to see you." And I said, "Hey, I'm gonna take off real quick. I think that we had 5 or 8 minutes before the show started,
right?"
And I ran down there, and I'd seen guys that I hadn't seen since '97. I hadn't seen Shea Muirbrook since '97, and I was really close to Shea, but. You know, we all go in our different ways, and he headed out to the Oakland Raiders for a time and then got going with whatever it was, military, and I think he's a sheriff now. And you just get going to life. And you may interact a little bit, but you don't get to see each other. Same with Darren Yancey. I hadn't seen him for years. And so I go over there, and I'm seeing these guys that, you know, you just – you bring it up well because that's your introduction into college football. That's the next step in life.
Right.
You're moving out. You're independent. You're all alone. You're looking for leadership. You're looking for mentors. You're looking for guidance and how you want to be in your life. And there all those guys were. Ed Kill making me laugh. You know, like Ed is just amazing. Those guys are all great. James Johnson and Derek Stevenson and, you know, Ben Cahoon, I could name probably about 25 or 30 guys. And I went over there and I buried my head in Yancey's chest and started crying and then had tears in my eyes and started hugging Shea and got worse. And, you know, hearing them say, "Hey, I'm proud of you. Hey, dude, this is awesome. Like, I've heard you on the call. Like, I can't believe you're calling the games." And getting some of those comments from guys that I've looked up to my whole life. Holy cow, man, that brings you full circle. And I came back to the booth, and you're right. I was riding as high as I've probably ridden in 5 years.
Yeah.
It was an amazing boost. And I still wear that white pullover at least once a week. It's one of my favorite pieces of clothing I've ever owned. It has a 96 logo on the side of it and a beautiful block BYU because it was on that block game. And
with the drop shadow.
With the drop shadow, as they call it.
Yeah.
And what an incredible tribute. And I was glad that they honored that team because it was such a unique, incredible team.
Something else happened in 1996. And there's a part of me that's kind of embarrassed that I hadn't heard about this. I didn't know this. And maybe I'm the only one that hasn't heard about this. But in 96, you saved somebody's life.
How'd you hear about that?
We have our ways.
That's funny.
This is not a story that I was ever informed about. You have not talked about this that I've heard. Can you tell people this story?
Yeah, it's a wild story. People won't believe it, but it's true. My uncle and I were given a medal as Heroes of the Year here in the state back in 1997, I think is when we were honored. But this happened November 5th of 1996. And my Uncle Orrin, who played at BYU, was living up in Alpine, was a bishop at the time. And he called and he said, I want to go fishing. And I remember saying, okay, let's go fishing. He bought me a 3-day license. And he said, I'm going to be at the house at 5:30 a.m. to pick you up. And we were headed up to Deer Creek with his father-in-law, who happened to be the BYU track and field coach at the time, Coach Robinson. Mm-hmm. And we get to the fourth, And I call him because the forecast was just pure snow. And I was like, Oren, it's just snowy. He's like, I already bought the license. I'm going to come pick you up. We can fight through a little snow. We're going to be fine. He picks me up. We head up to Deer Creek. And we're fishing on the east side of Deer Creek where that inlet comes in. I don't know if you know where mm-hmm. the inlet yep. comes in. Yep. So it's not all the way over on the Heber side, right. but it's before you start turning towards Heber. There's an inlet there. And it was about a 50-foot drop off the road from that inlet. And then there was a massive pool of water and then a stream that would go in that feeds into Deer Creek. So we started out fishing that stream at about – we got there at about 6:15 in the morning, somewhere in there. And we started fishing the stream. And Oren's like, let's go down the stream a little bit. We'll try down the stream. So we're about 70 yards away from the road and the 50-foot drop and that fishing hole that we were going to eventually fish down to and then fish the fishing hole. And it's about 6:45, 7 o'clock in the morning. Oren had slipped in with his leg, so he was wet all the way up to the hip. It was sideways snow, and it was freezing. And I remember I'm standing there like, what are we doing? This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. What are we doing? And then we hear this crazy screech, and we look, and this truck comes flying off the road. And it lands on the front part of it, and then it starts into a cartwheel. And it just started cartwheeling down the side of the hill mm-hmm. and lands upside down in that fishing hole. And so you could see the tires, and you could see where the truck came down, but your mind just doesn't know how
process
to, it doesn't process
yeah.
it. Because you're like, you're in this serene fishing hole with sideways snow, and now you got this truck that's flown off this cliff and landed upside down in this water, and you're like, what is going on?
Yeah.
Well, my Uncle Oren, who is an absolute beast of a man. I don't know if you've met Oren.
I have not.
Oh, dude, he's a beast of a man. And he was I always give him a hard time. He took second in state wrestling, and I took first in wrestling. And we never let it happen on the mat, but we always entertained it. But we were both, you know, I was college-level good health then, and Oren was still probably 245, 250, lean mass, stud, you know, strong yeah. guy. He runs to the truck, and he's yelling at me. I think he's in the truck, saying that whoever
the driver
drove it off, I think he's in the truck. Well, your mind doesn't let you think that there's somebody under this freezing cold water while the snow's coming down on it. Your mind doesn't let you think, oh, there's somebody trapped under there. Your mind goes to, well, okay, where is this person? So I'm scanning the hill because I thought for sure he'd gotten thrown out of the truck because it was flipping like, you know, one of these BYU gymnasts on a floor routine. It was all over the place. And he was a construction worker. He had one of those power wagons.
Okay.
And he had a massive toolbox back in the back of the truck, one of those old flip-up steel toolboxes. And it opened and it flung tools everywhere. And so I'm looking all over the place for this man. I thought for sure he'd flown out of the truck. Oren's standing at the edge of the bank, and he's looking down. And he says, he's in the truck. And I said, there's no way he's in the truck. And all of a sudden, the horn starts honking under the water. So you hear this underwater. And he's yelling, come down here. He's in the truck. Meanwhile, his father-in-law was too far down the river, didn't mm-hmm. even know that this was going on. So Oren jumps into the water. He's the first to jump in the water. And he starts fishing down. You know, it's deep enough that he had to get down just about where his face is in the water, and his arm is extended into the window. Mm-hmm. He gets a hold of the guy, and he's trying to pull him out. And Oren comes back up, and he goes, he's kicking at me. I can't get him out of the window. He's kicking at me. And he said, get in here. And I'm looking at it like, it looks cold, Oren. It's cold water, Oren. It's snowing. I don't know what you're doing. And I'm like, okay, let's do this. So I jump down in the water, and he says, he's kicking at me. He pushed away and kicked at me. He said, so what we're going to do, you and I are going to go down. We're going to get as much cloth as we can, and we're going to pull until he's out the window. And I was like, okay. He said, you ready? I said, okay. One, two, three. We both kind of go down.
Mm-hmm.
We get our hands full of cloth, and we pull this dude to the window. And when we pulled him to the window, we're like, oh, no, this dude ain't coming out. Like, he's not coming out. And Oren was like, pull. So we're pulling and kind of resetting our hands and pulling. And you got these two, you know, one to be NFL guy, former NFL guy. Oren played with the Chiefs. And we are cranking on whatever this body is that's stuck in this truck. And it's not moving much. So we didn't know at that point if he was drowned or unconscious or what. So we're heaving, and we finally pop his head out, and we get his head above water, and he's gasping. He's alive, and yeah. He's gasping. We get him out of that truck, and we stand him on the shore, and this dude is about 6'6", 6'7", 380 pounds.
Wow.
His name was Tom Swan, and he's standing next to Oren and I, who are big dudes, and we're looking up at this guy, and the snow is coming sideways. And we're all freaking, you know, soaked to the bone. And we're all looking, the three of us are looking at each other like, what in the heck? Nobody's saying a word. You're just looking at each other. Tom's looking at the two of us like, what are you doing here at 7 o'clock in the morning? What are you doing? It's snowing side. Why are you here on this shore at 7 o'clock in the morning? And we're looking at him like, you are big. You're a big man. And you know, it was this realization of, holy cow, like, you're right place, right time.
It's a faith builder, isn't it?
This was all inspired by Oren. I put this all on Oren. First of all, he's the real hero, and he was inspired to keep us on that river at 7 o'clock in the morning on a November 5th with sideways snow. He was the one that put us there. And Oren's always been very close to his Heavenly Father. I think he's been a bishop like four times. He's served like eight missions. I told him, when you get translated, if you could, put in a good word. Because he's not touching death. He's just the twinkle of an eye guy. And I'm like, hey, put in a good word for me. And it was all inspired by him. So, Shep, this guy had a scratch on his knuckles, and that was it. Other than that, totally fine. And the reason he was kicking away, the cab instantly filled with water because all the windows smashed out and the top of the cab smashed down, and it left about a foot and a half room in that window. That's what we pulled him through. That's why it was so hard to pull
him. A guy that was that tall and 380.
Yeah. It was about a foot and a half window space that cab had smashed down to. So that's why it was so hard to pull him out. The reason he was kicking away from Oren, the only air left in the truck was in the floorboard. And so he was up gulping.
Oh, he was getting as much, the only yes, air he could at the time.
Was at the floorboard.
Oh.
So he was up trying to gulp at the floorboard, and something was pulling at his leg. And when we talked to him, he said, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. It's sideways snow. He said, what would you think is pulling at your leg?
Oh, he thought it was an animal.
Yeah. He's like, why would you, like, what would you ever think would be pulling at your leg in that moment? He's like, so I kicked away from it because I needed the air, and I didn't know what had me. And he said, and then when I had both of you grab me, I had no idea, like, what was happening to me. And he said there was a point where he felt like it was some type of supernatural force. Like, he was like, what else would explain having two dudes that could possibly rip you out of a truck? And so the whole thing, Shep, is it gives me chills to think about it. And I don't talk a ton about it. But do you remember That's the Rest of the Story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Paul Harvey.
Paul Harvey did it on That's the Rest of the Story.
Wow.
Yeah. It was I actually have the recording of it. Paul Harvey did, he read the whole story out. And he goes, and that's the rest of the story. And it was us. It was me and Oren.
Wow.
But Tom came to my wedding. Tom really stayed around as long as he could. And I've kind of lost touch with him. But I've thought about him a lot. I think he had three or four daughters. And he was able to be a dad and do his thing. But,
wow.
Yeah, crazy story that you bring that up. I haven't talked about it in a long time.
I don't know how we transition from that back to your BYU career, but we'll do our best here. What a story, by the way.
Is that wild?
That was
my freshman year down here.
Wow. Yeah. So when you look back at your career, and we've already touched on a couple of those things. Obviously, you were there for the 96 season to be able to witness that. You know, you bookended your career with the miracle for Lavelle at beating the Utes at the very end of the game in Salt Lake City. When you look back at your BYU career, how do you look back on it?
Amanda Olson. That's it.
Yeah.
I look back at it as Amanda Olson, marrying her in the temple. The greatest accomplishment of my life is Amanda Olson. And it's the greatest thing that I took from this university was Amanda Olson. Now, she was a UVU girl, and I don't hold that against her. In fact, UVU girls were always better at dating. They always felt just a little bit more light and a little bit more laughter. So I always dated UVU girls when I could, and Amanda Olson's the greatest thing to happen to me in my time here. And I'll never forget being sealed to her in the temple and having Lavelle Edwards and Tom Ramage and some of my teammates and my parents and her parents, her mom, in that sealing room. And if you were to ask me, boil down a single moment of BYU that means the most to you, that's the moment. Is finding my eternal companion and being able to be married to her for time and all eternity in this amazing church and in this amazing gospel that I continue to try to grow in. It's a continual effort.
Yeah, it is for all of us.
I have a true, like, undying testimony, but I am not the historian. I am working on it. You know, I'm trying to become more the historian and understand the depths of the gospel. I definitely understand more the people that have rebuilt this gospel on earth. But what an amazing thing to be able to take from your school, a person that you get to spend the rest of your life with. And she is my best friend. And she is, you feel like somebody was created on this earth for you. And that's Amanda Olson. And I got to find her here. And with that comes a lot of other great relationships with teammates and coaches lost. Shit, my coaches are passing on, man. Yeah. And it's been really hard to watch those amazing men that set the standard for me pass on. I've attended a lot of funerals here, and it's been rough. But what a great thing to say that you could take from your time in college football is the perfect eternal companion. And that's Amanda.
So I want to ask you one last question before we wrap up. I think we all at some point in our life always wonder, well, I wonder what would have happened if. You ever think back on that moment when you told Tom Osborne, yes, sir, let's go? You imagine what you would have missed out on had you decided to go to Nebraska?
Yeah, so I've played it out quite a few times in my mind. And in that vein of trying to continue to find more clarity in the gospel and to be better as a man in this church, because I've got a lot of room to work. Where I was at that point and the choices that I was making, I have a pretty good idea of where I would have ended up. And I don't like it. I don't like the thought of where I would have ended up, because it feels like every diagram I draw of the potential path of that choice probably puts me outside of the gospel, definitely puts me outside of an eternal marriage to Amanda. And it probably drops me in a layer of confusion, and my guess is regret. And I say that, Shep, because when you grow up in the gospel and then at some point you decide the gospel is false or the church isn't true or there were lies or there's no facts, there's no truth to its restored nature. You can't help but reflect back in the lessons that you learned when you were younger. As much as you want to fight it, as much as you want to kick it out and say it's all wrong, you'll never forget the wholesome feeling. You'll never forget that point of security. You'll never forget learning of Christ. You'll never forget the warmth of your mom and dad. You'll never forget the warmth that the Spirit gave you in those maybe few moments.
Yeah.
But they're moments that sit on you. And so I've pictured myself in this decision, falling away from the gospel, probably marrying somebody outside of the church. I might have found happiness in a different form, but I think I would have always reflected on the beautiful feelings that you get around pure love and the support of your Heavenly Father and the support of your parents and the constant reassuring nature that the church brings you. Even if you sit in the back pew on a Sunday and you're late and you're sitting there and you hear that one comment that hits you in the heart and you're like, geez, man, that's a moment of warmth that I couldn't get anywhere else. It's something that you can't. It leaves a hole in your heart that you actually have to turn. People always wonder why people that fall away from the church get so angry towards the church. It's the only way to combat it, because you know you had those moments. And the only way to explain it, or the only way to stay away from it, is to combat it and to search reasons to make it ugly and fake. And I think about being in a marriage outside of the church with a different woman, raising kids without the gospel. And I'm sure I would have had happiness. I just don't like the alternative, Shep. I like what I have. And I love that I can turn towards my Heavenly Father. I love that I've got that safety net. I love that my wife and I can look at each other like, hey, I know you're following the rules. I'm following the rules. That makes it really easy to trust each other.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know that trust is the cornerstone. And trust being the cornerstone, well, what is the meaning? What is the backing of trust? It is your Heavenly Father.
Yeah.
So it's a choice that I think about a lot. And you bring it up and it's like, you know, I'm a deep thinker.
Yeah.
My thoughts go really deep and I'll sit and think and dwell on these things. And every direction, every way you look at it, whatever the end result would have been, it couldn't have touched what this result is and where this university and where that decision has led me.
I can't thank you enough for being willing to come in and do this today. This was so much fun. You and I have worked around each other for so long, and I have thoroughly enjoyed being able to get to know you on a much more personal level over the last couple of seasons. I truly do consider you a friend, and I love working with you, man.
Back at you, Shep. Right back at you, dude. I love those pre and posts and everything that we get to do together, and I look forward to a lot more years of it.
Yep. Well, thank you for doing this. I hope you enjoyed it, because this was so much fun.
Just do it again, man, if you ever need me.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it. Thanks once again to my guest, Hans Olson. My name is Jason Shepherd. This episode was produced by Ben Hall. Deep Blue's senior producer is Cleon Wall. You can download and subscribe to Deep Blue on all podcast platforms or find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.